12-18-2067, Madison Teachers, Inc. et al. Versus Scott Walker et al. And here is the lineup I have for the oral argument. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen will argue for 35 minutes, and Kevin St. John will argue for 5 minutes. That is 40 minutes of your direct argument. Tamara Packard of Cullen Weston will argue for 5 minutes. M. Nickel Padway will argue for 15 minutes. Lester A. Padway of Padway and Padway. Lester A. Pines of Cullen Weston will argue for 25 minutes. That makes a total of 45 minutes. And Mr. Van Hollen will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Any changes? That's it, counsel. 12AP 2067, General J.D. Van Hollen.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Well, the parties here today agree, as they must, that there is no constitutional right to collective bargaining. We find ourselves here today arguing, oddly, I believe, that the collective bargaining provisions within Act 10 somehow violate the challenger's constitutional rights. There is no basis in the law to support such a finding. It is certainly not a constitutional violation to limit the scope of collective bargaining, since it is not a constitutional violation to eliminate collective bargaining as a whole. That is exactly the argument that challengers make. No matter how they spin it, no matter how many ways they come at it, the essential challenge is that if collective bargaining is to be permitted at all, it must be permitted without limit. If challengers' arguments are accepted, it would completely change public sector labor law as we know it. Pre-Act 10 MIRA would be unconstitutional, as would be every public sector labor code in the history of Wisconsin, as would be every public sector labor code in the country. While collective bargaining would be, as said in the board case, as it would be an act of legislative grace, if it was permitted at all, it would have to be unlimited. The state must necessarily be able to pick a subset of subjects which can be bargained over to the exclusion of others. Challengers may wish the law required otherwise, and pre-Act 10, the law indeed did require otherwise, but it is far from constitutionally required. Quite simply, if collective bargaining had never existed prior to Act 10, and Act 10 had created public sector collective bargaining for the sake of public employees in the state of Wisconsin, for the purpose of base wages, nobody here today would be arguing that that was unconstitutional. In fact, those employees who had found this newfound benefit, in addition to the jobs they had and the abilities they had to bargain over things if their employee and the employer wished, they would have this newfound benefit of being able to mandate that their government employers came to the table and bargained with them in good faith over the issue of base wages.
Counsel, one, I don't think anyone is arguing that there is a constitutional right to have collective bargaining. I think there's agreement on the parties, and if there's disagreement, the plaintiffs here will tell us when it's their turn. Two, from the perspective of the state, as I understand your briefs, the state in Act 10 is conferring a benefit, namely collective bargaining on wages.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But I'm sure the state will agree that when the state confers a benefit by law, that it can, that it has limitations as to the conditions it can put on that benefit. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Okay. So isn't the argument here whether the limitations are valid?
That is part of the argument, Your Honor. However, the state argues, and I think the facts bear out the fact, that there are no conditions or limitations placed upon those who choose to accept that benefit that is imposed, that is given to them or provided to them by virtue of collective bargaining.
Okay, now the counter-argument is there are limitations on those who choose collective bargaining, and that is to join a union and have the union certified, right?
I believe that is their contention. It's
okay.
Certainly a contention without basis, Your Honor.
Contention nevertheless, and the court will have to decide whether there is or is not a basis. Now, the other thing I understand from the briefs is that the issue is to determine whether there are limitations and what they are, and then if there are limitations, are they fundamental so that they're subject to strict scrutiny, or are they not fundamental so that it's only rational basis?
I think we have to back up from there, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think we have to back up from there because, first of all, the contention of challengers is that even though there is not a constitutional right to collective bargaining, that there is a constitutional right to associate for the purposes of collective bargaining.
I believe agree with that?
Correct? Pardon?
Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor.
No constitutional right to associate.
For the purposes of collective bargaining.
How do we define collective bargaining? As in the statute?
Correct.
Okay. All right. We backed up that far. Continue on.
Okay. We would further contend that there is no association that is hampered at all within the context of Act 10. There is a clear disparity in challengers' arguments that needs to be pointed out, and that is that the constant reference to unions and collective bargaining units or collective bargaining representatives as if they're the same thing. They're the two terms that are repeatedly conflated. And I think that is something that this Court needs to closely look at and take into account.
Okay. But in other words, a collective bargaining unit need not be a labor union, but it is some collective. It is some organization or entity to which people belong, right?
Correct, but okay. It is unlike a labor union and unlike most associations, it's a unit or a gathering or a group of people who have not placed themselves together voluntarily. They are placed together by the state of Wisconsin as a collective bargaining unit by virtue of that selection. Many people may wish, if they were in that collective bargaining unit, that they were not. It's not an association that they choose voluntarily, which is another distinction between it and labor unions.
Counsel, what I understood you to say is that while there is a constitutional right for and a freedom of association to unionize, there has not been recognized yet a constitutional right for collective bargaining.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it has been clearly held that there is not a constitutional right to collective bargaining, as we all agree. It's clearly held that there is a constitutional right to associate. But in the Roberts v. J.C.'s case, it clearly held that that constitutional right of association only exists if it's for the purposes of advancing some fundamental First Amendment right, which, as we've all conceded, collective bargaining is not.
That's what I understood your answer to be to the Chief Justice, but I just wanted to make sure everyone else understood.
Mr. Van Hollen, if I might, let me zero in on what I think is one of the key factors in determining which side is right in this case. And that's the whole issue that was touched upon a little earlier, the issue of judicial scrutiny, whether we should be looking at strict scrutiny or rational basis. Now, I understand the state takes the position that rational basis is the right test. Would you tell me why?
Absolutely, Your Honor. For strict scrutiny to be the test, we have to actually have a fundamental right or a constitutional right that is implicated in this case. And when you look at the arguments of the challengers, whether they be the freedom of association for the purposes of collective bargaining argument, whether they be the unconstitutional conditions argument that they put forth in the Lawson case, or whether it be the freedom or the equal protection arguments that they put forth, all of them require an underlying bit of evidence that associating for the purpose of collective bargaining is a fundamental right. And if that is not a fundamental right, and we submit to you that there is no basis in law to find that it is, then the rational basis test applies and strict scrutiny does not.
Why do you think that the Lawson case is not controlling here? That was the case, as I understand it, that Judge Colas felt was the key case and led him to the idea of strict scrutiny.
Well, Your Honor, the Lawson case, I think, loses out on a number of different categories and comparisons. First of all, as I mentioned just previously in your answer, Lawson also requires that there is some fundamental or constitutional right that it is deprived or violated for purposes of obtaining a benefit, whether it be a public benefit or whether it be a statutory benefit. It also requires that there be a condition placed upon receiving that benefit that is unconstitutional. And in this case, not only do we not have a constitutional violation, we have no associational rights of challengers that are violated whatsoever or that are changed whatsoever. And very importantly, getting back to the Chief Justice's original question, there are no burdens. There are no penalties. The reality is represented and non-represented government employees in this case are treated the same in every category, with the exception of the fact that representative employees have the additional benefit of being able to collectively bargain over the issue of base wages. So there is no penalty for associating for that purpose, even if it were a fundamental right for association.
Counsel, I notice in the answers to your questions in regard to strict scrutiny and an earlier question posed by the Chief Justice that you said there are no fundamental or constitutional rights that then would require us to use strict scrutiny. Does every constitutional right require strict scrutiny or just some constitutional rights?
No, I don't believe they all do, Your Honor, but within the context of this case, it's our argument that we never get to the point of even discussing strict scrutiny. Because whether some constitutional rights are required or not, there are no constitutional rights that are implicated within the context of this case.
What about free speech and the right to petition the government?
Well, obviously, those are fundamental rights. Those are constitutional rights, Your Honor. But once again, those are rights that are not implicated within the context of this case.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm a school teacher. Okay? I always wanted to be a school teacher. And I
Some days I want to be one.
I was a school teacher. So I went astray, and here I am. I'm a school teacher. If I'm part of a collective bargaining unit, may I petition my employer to give me wage increase in excess of the wage increase that is set forth in the statute?
Absolutely, you may, Your Honor, which puts you on the same footing as a non-representative employee who may or do the same if they wish. Of course, unlike collective bargaining, it is the employer's prerogative to not listen, to say no, to decline, whatever the case may be.
You're saying while my collective bargaining unit is trying to get wage increases for me under the Consumer Price Index, I can go and try and seek a higher wage than that. My rights as an individual remain.
That's correct, Your Honor.
At all times.
Correct.
Okay, now I'm not in a collective bargaining unit. I'm teacher next county, next school district over. And that school teacher has exactly the same rights, you say, right? That is...
That school teacher certainly has the rights to approach their
right.
school, ask for different conditions.
Right. Ask for different wages. I'm just on wages now. The two employees are equally treated in the same, they're both school teachers, same situation, right?
With the exception of the fact that the one can collectively bargain through their collective bargaining unit for the purposes of establishing wages as well.
And that you view as a benefit. So I got two things if I'm a teacher that has a collective bargaining representative.
Absolutely.
So I'm better off, you say.
Absolutely. Okay. And if it were not for the fact that the ability to collectively bargain was considered an additional benefit, I don't think anybody would be here today advocating and litigating over the potential loss of the certain subject matters over which they could collectively bargain.
Now, but my collective bargaining unit can only bargain on wages. That's what the statute says.
That's what Act 10 says, correct?
So, now, can I go ahead and seek to negotiate with my school board or whoever's going to negotiate with me on terms and conditions of employment?
You may.
I may. I'm free to do that.
You as an individual, not you as a collective bargaining representative.
Right. And the same thing is true of my colleague here who is not in a collective bargaining unit.
Right.
So you're saying as to these employees, they have precisely the same rights, but I got more.
Correct.
Okay.
They have precisely the same rights. You have an added benefit.
Pardon me? I have an added benefit. Right. I give up nothing by being in the collective bargaining unit as an individual employee.
Well, it's not necessarily true because...
What do I give up?
Okay. Well, if you are a member who is involuntarily placed in that collective bargaining unit who does not agree that you want to collectively bargain over the purposes of wages, and you did not vote for a collective bargaining agent or representative, you are still stuck being represented by that individual for the purposes of negotiating those wages, whether you wanted them or not. Obviously, an associational interest that the Supreme Court has found to be questionable but upheld.
That's right. I accept that. Of course, you don't know how I voted because that's secret.
Sure.
And the statute, as I understand it. Okay. Now, let's take it from the association standpoint. The collective bargaining unit is limited to deal only with wages and only to the extent permitted under the statute, right?
For purposes of collective bargaining, that's correct.
And the statute says, I have to be careful about what the statute says, it prohibits the, I think that's 4MB, the municipal employer is prohibited from bargaining collectively with a collective bargaining unit containing a general municipal employee with respect to factor or condition of employment except the wages that we kept talking about. Okay? Now, you said that I as an employee can go to the employer. They don't have to listen to me, but I can go to them and seek wages in excess of the statutory wage increase, right?
Correct.
Can the municipal employer, can the school board meet and confer, isn't that the language of the statute, meet and confer with the collective bargaining unit to talk about wages in excess of the limit in the statutes and terms and conditions of employment?
Meet and confer, but not bargain. They're limited to what they can collectively bargain over. For the sole purpose, as I'm backing up, getting to the agreed not decision, they're not elected to bargain for anything beyond that because that's all the statute would permit them to bargain for.
Okay. So they can go and they can talk to the school board, the school, the district. So they're not barred. They have the same rights I have.
Now, are you talking about an employee in a collective bargaining unit, or are you talking about the collective bargaining representative?
Both. They have the same rights. The collective bargaining unit has the same rights I do to go and talk to the employer, right? That's your position.
Well, the collective bargaining representative can go talk to an employer about whatever they may wish, just like an individual who's non-represented. However, they cannot collectively bargain with them or come to terms with them over issues beyond. Keeping in mind, the collective bargaining representative is an individual. It may be a union. It may be a non-union. The reality is in that capacity, they're going to have the opportunity, as they've always had, which is why they don't have a restriction on their freedom of association, to continue to meet with and bargain for and argue for a number of different things.
The school board's going to have to come out with, you teacher get X amount of money. You teacher do X, Y, and Z. You teacher... Here are the terms and conditions, right?
Under the non-collective bargaining argument that you're asking, Your Honor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, which is part of the argument for the rational basis by the state for doing this, is they have no more freedom to use the budget to reward those who are more deserving of reward and reward those less who are less deserving, something that even with the collective bargaining arrangement as it exists pre-Act 10 has been done. If you look at the amicus brief, actually filed on behalf of the challengers from the city of Madison, it actually indicates that that's exactly what they have done, that they continue to negotiate with non-represented employees, similar to the way that they negotiate with represented employees, because they want to have that opportunity to approach all of them and negotiate with all of them and not necessarily some to the exclusion of others.
You don't think that's avoidance of this statute?
Avoidance of the statute? Mm-hmm. Absolutely not.
Counsel, I'd like to return to strict scrutiny or rational basis. And which is it? Because the Court of Appeals notes in its certification that that's really an essential issue in this case. The Court of Appeals also says in its certification on page 11, it says, the state officials do not contend that the challenged provisions survive strict scrutiny. Is that your position?
That's correct.
You concede that if strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard to apply, that the challenged provisions will not survive?
Correct. We believe the case is so clear that strict scrutiny would not be applied that there is no reason to debate the success if strict scrutiny were applied.
Yes, and that's really what my question and I have a follow-up question, but that's what it was focused on. It's not only that you don't contend that the challenge provisions survive strict scrutiny, but you concede that they would not survive strict scrutiny. See, I'm moving you a little, and that's what I'm intentionally trying to do. So, and it seems like you moved.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm very fine with the concept that if a constitutional right is violated here, that strict scrutiny applies, and that challengers succeed. And that if a constitutional right is not applicable to this case or is not violated, that rational basis applies and the state succeeds.
That's right. The Court of Appeals in its certification at the beginning of its discussion says, watch out for terminology here, folks. Do you recall that part of their certification? If not, let me amplify.
Feel free.
Okay. It says, terminology. We begin our more detailed summary of the issue by clarifying our use of the term collective bargaining. In essence, they say, it's used two ways. One involves the right of an individual citizen to associate together for the purpose of advocating regarding matters of mutual interest or concern, in particular, matters concerning wages and employment conditions. When you talk about collective bargaining or bargaining collectively, the term is descriptive of a collective effort and refers to an activity where the party that is the object of the advocacy, the employer, has no legal obligation to respond affirmatively. And they go on to say, that kind of right of an individual to associate together, that's a fundamental right. I know you believe that here we are not talking about that kind of right, but do you acknowledge that there is a constitutional right of an individual citizen to associate together for the purpose of advocating regarding matters of mutual interest or concern, in particular matters concerning wages and employment conditions. Do you acknowledge there exists such a constitutional right?
Your Honor, to phrase it in my terms, as I wish to do, I do acknowledge that there is a constitutional right to associate, and there is a constitutional right to associate for all those purposes contained within the First Amendment. And nothing beyond that. And it is none of those constitutional rights, of course, that are being abridged in any manner whatsoever in this case, and there are no associational rights whatsoever that are being abridged in this case.
Do you acknowledge that there is a constitutional right to associate with regard to matters concerning wages and employment conditions? A right of an individual citizen to associate for purposes of matters concerning wages and employment conditions?
With each other? Yes. With the government under the confines of a statutory collective bargaining unit for the purposes of collective bargaining? Absolutely not.
You know, I see in this case, counsel, that's where the two ships are passing, that your opponents see the right of citizens to associate together for this purpose as a constitutional right of association, and it's implicated. You take apparently what the Court of Appeals calls the second way in which the term collective bargaining has been used, and that is to refer to the statutory provisions.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe the two ships pass in the night. I believe they collide. And the state has the bigger ship, and we shall win. And the reason, therefore, is because none of us debate whether they have a constitutional right to associate as a union for purposes of the things that you so described.
Yes,
what we
counsel.
Say is they do not have the constitutional right to associate for collective bargaining, which is clearly the case under the Roberts decision.
They do not have the constitutional right to statutorily collective bargain. Is that your position?
Absolutely.
Okay, but don't they have a constitutional right as an individual to associate with others for whatever purpose that's a lawful purpose, including purposes concerning wages and employment conditions?
Yes, and Act 10 takes away none of those associational rights.
But you acknowledge there is such an association right?
Yes.
Thanks.
Could you talk about the Home Rule Amendment and the issue there, particularly in reviewing a claim, what test are we supposed to apply?
Your Honor, the test under the constitutional amendment with regards to home rule, I think, is quite clearly set forth in the law, but also then set forth in Sleeman v. Baxter, Van Gilder v. Madison, West Allis, Thompson, and the list goes on. And that test to apply is that if the state passes a law which applies with uniformity to every city, village, municipality throughout the state, that that is an exception to the Home Rule Amendment. Another standard is that if they pass a law which is primarily a statewide concern, then it defeats as well, for that purpose, the Home Rule Amendment. One of those need apply, not both. The case law is quite clear on that, Your Honor, and it's the argument of the state that not only have both prongs been met, but the uniformity prong has clearly been met. And it's been met by virtue of those portions of the Act itself. Act 10, Sections 74, 166, 167, and 171 individually lay out the employee pension contribution requirement issue, and how it will apply to populous counties, populous cities, and non-populous of the same as well. If there has ever been an act that's been more uniformly applied, I know not of it.
Mr. Van Hollen, let's assume for a minute that both prongs are necessary, uniformity and statewide concern. I know the state takes an alternative position that if that's the test, that test is met. Would you explain how it's met in regard to the statewide concern issue?
Absolutely, and part of the reasons, Your Honor, why the courts have held that uniformity is all that need apply is because they have also held that uniformity in and of itself establishes a statewide concern. That's a very clear directive that can be found from the Court of Appeals in the Roberson case. But in addition to that, it's the contention that from the state that obviously this is a case of statewide significance. One look no further than what Act 10 does and what it establishes and what its purposes are. And its purposes are to obviously bring the budget under control. And to bring the budget under control, there need to be potentially fewer state aids that go out to municipalities. And because of that, municipalities have to have within their control the ability to control their budgets in other ways as well. And because of that, this is necessarily an area of statewide concern.
Wasn't one of the other purposes, at least what was set out in the state's brief, the hope that by lessening the burden of municipal and other statewide employees on the employer, that the different levels of government throughout the state would have money to put into economic generation to try to right what was termed, I think, a crisis in economics throughout the state?
That was set forth, Your Honor, and it was set forth as a concern because obviously local budgets themselves aren't dependent upon just local money. They're dependent upon state money. And those local budgets not only are going to fund the employee portion of the pension fund, the employee contribution, but they fund law enforcement. They fund all sorts of other public works, other aspects of local government as well that have been deemed of mutual concern between local and state, and to make sure that they have the ability to balance all of those numerous interests within the context of limited resources.
Council, I want to move you to the – I see you have 5 minutes left. I want to move you to the stay. Are you still asking for a stay?
I will turn it over to Deputy.
Okay. Well, just wait then. If he's handling that, I didn't know that how you were dividing up. Let me ask you whether the WERC has ceased from going forward with the elections.
I believe they have.
All right. So you would prefer that I direct the questions of the state to Mr. St. John?
That is the way we divided it, Your Honor.
That's fine, Counsel. We will just proceed with you, and I will wait. Thank you. Counsel, I have one more question about the home rule and things being of statewide concern. If I buy the breadth of the state's argument that the expenditures of funds by local units of government has a statewide impact, is there any limit on that? Couldn't we then say, well, what happens to the Home Rule Amendment altogether? Because every dollar that a municipality spends, if it has that broad of an impact, just say a municipality wanted to enact a park. Well, could the state pass a law saying, nope, there can be no more parks, authorized by any municipal government? I have some concerns about the breadth of the argument.
Well, and this is where it's important to understand the history and the scope of the jurisprudence of the Home Rule Amendment. The Home Rule Amendment, as was set forth and defined in case law, was done so not necessarily as a limitation upon state government to intrude into local affairs, but as authoritative and permissive to give local units of government, in this case municipalities, the opportunity to operate in the void of state legislation. So it was permissive to the locals, but not restrictive necessarily to the legislature, which is why the holdings have found that if the legislature applies a new statute uniformly, that it is going to supersede the Home Rule Amendment with regards to that statute. But with regards to statewide concern, that you then get into the issue of, is it primarily of statewide concern or primarily of local concern, as was set out in the Eckern case, or is it some combination thereof? And that it will be necessarily within the prerogative of the courts in that case to determine whether a case is primarily of local concern or primarily of statewide concern. So as you ask, necessarily there's going to be a commingling of monies. Therefore, is it always statewide concern? No, the courts have clearly held that it is not always. But the one place where they have clearly held that it is always an exception to the Home Rule Amendment is when it's uniformly applied, which it is in this case.
Thank you. Counsel, the Milwaukee Charter Ordinance, which is 3613-2G, states every member, retired member, survivor, and beneficiary who participates in the combined fund shall have a vested and contractual right to the benefits in the amount and on the terms and conditions as provided in the law on the date the combined fund is created. Seems to me that language is pretty clear, that there is a contractual relationship established. Do you disagree?
Well, Your Honor, if you think it's clear, you should read the numerous pages of the challengers on the issue and the numerous pages of the states on the issue, and it will no longer be clear to you.
Let's parse it then. Milwaukee Charter Ordinance 3613-2G. Every member, retired member, survivor, and beneficiary. That's pretty clear?
It's clear if you take it out of context, certainly, Your Honor.
I'll put it in context. I don't want to take anything out of context. I'm just reading it and finding what's clear and what's not clear. Is that clear to you?
Clear as to what?
What, every member, retired member, survivor, and beneficiary. Are you saying that's unclear language?
I guess it's not a complete sentence. Whatever it's attempting to define, it may be clear.
Who participates in the combined fund shall have a vested and contractual right.
That, I would submit, certainly is not clear.
Mm-hmm. I would argue
that is two things. It is something that is beyond the ability of the City of Milwaukee in this case to declare, for a number of different reasons, one of which is the...
You're saying it says what it says, but they can't do it. I mean, the language is clear, it's just that they can't do it.
No, there are other subsections within the ordinance as well that make it less clear. But I don't think we need to get to the debate over the ordinance itself and whether it's clear or whether it's not clear, because the reality is twofold. First of all, no matter how they may want to, in the ordinance, define the term vested, vested is a term of legal art that has been developed certainly in common law, certainly in the most recent cases of nurses that came down since we filed briefs in this case, which cites the Loaf case as well, a decision of this court that indicates that rights are not vested until all the work to obtain that right or that benefit has actually been complied with. And therefore, the ordinances, even if they were to clearly say that it's a vested right just by virtue of the employment. So if the City of Milwaukee was to say that even if I quit my job as a Milwaukee City employer, they're going to continue to contribute to my pension because that's what they agreed to do when I got hired. Even if they wanted to do that, common law prohibits them from doing so. In addition to that, the law has continually recognized that these local municipalities, local units of government, which are states within a state created by the legislature, do not have the power or the ability to contract in such a way that cannot be affected or altered by virtue of future legislation. And if you look back in the history of the jurisprudence of this court, I think you will find very few times, maybe a handful of times, where statutes have been found void, and they would have been found void under those contexts for completely unrelated reasons than the facts that we have before us today.
So do I understand the focus of your concern about clarity is on the word vested and whether or not it's vested and not on the word contractual right? In other words, every member, retired member, survivor, and beneficiary who participates in the combined fund shall have a vested and contractual right. This seems to me, to hearing your argument, that you're arguing about whether something is vested is unclear. If it's vested, there is a contractual right, then. Is that what you're saying?
I'll have to back up. You started in the middle of an argument that I would make, and to make the argument completely, I need to back up to the beginning of it, Your Honor. And the beginning of it is that there is no binding contractual right whatsoever. Regardless of what the ordinances say, the law states that the legislature has the ability to, if you will, impair contracts that are between the municipalities and That was what was done in this case, so there was not a contract. Secondly, if you found there was a contract, it was clearly a unilateral contract. To find consideration when an employee can up and walk away anytime they want, but for some reason then the employer is still bound to perform aspects that they had agreed to at the time of hiring, certainly flies in the face of contracts. And then lastly, I would argue, as I believe was argued by, has been argued by the challengers, that this is a vested right within the contract and therefore can't be taken away. And their definition of vested right, whether it be what the ordinance says or not, is contrary to the common law definition of vested right as found by this court.
That helps. I think, as I understand it, then your first argument is they can't, may say that, but they can't do it. But even if they could, it's unilateral, so they can't do it. And then you focus on whether or not what vested means. Do I now have a full understanding of your argument on that?
Pretty close, Your Honor.
Thank you. And the ordinance says that the board shall kick in 5.5%, I think that is. So that doesn't count either.
Well, it certainly does in the absence of legislation. Obviously, they, by virtue of that shall, they were. State legislation has and permissibly can change that, in which case no longer shall they.
On what do you base that the legislature can impair a contract of a local government?
Your Honor, that is a decision that came down in a number of different categories. The first one, or the most recent one, I would say, the municipalities, its instrumentalities of the state, have no authority to enter into contracts that are not subject to legislative activity. It was in the Madison Metropolitan Sewerage case. It was also in the McKenna case and the City of Kenosha case.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll move, Steve.
Mr. St. John, Assistant Attorney General, Wisconsin Deputy Attorney General, Kevin St. John. You're going to talk about the stays.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. With respect to the contempt order, I wish to make 3 points. First, the commissioners were not in contempt of the Circuit Court's declaratory judgment order. As a matter of law, declaratory judgments can never give rise to contempt.
I'm sorry.
Because
you've got two requests for a stay, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you don't mind, I would like to start with the stay, the motion to this court to stay the Circuit Court's September 14, 2012 final order and all subsequent orders. Right? Okay. Let's talk about that.
Sure. The state moved this court to stay the declaratory judgment after the Dane County Circuit Court had used the declaratory judgment and interpreted the declaratory judgment as somehow commanding the commissioners to take an action or refrain from taking a certain action. So at that time, the harm to the state.
Let me just double back. As to the original September 14, 2012 final order, you requested a stay in the trial court almost immediately.
Yes, we did.
You were unsuccessful.
That's correct.
You then went to the Court of Appeals and asked for a stay of the September 14, 2012 order, and you were unsuccessful, and I think that was in March, right?
That's correct.
Of 2013. You did not come here, did you?
No, we did not. We took solace in the fact that the Court of Appeals rejected the notion outright, the contention out of hand, that order had statewide effect.
All right. So now you're here again on the September 14, 2012 order?
That is correct.
Okay. So 8 months later.
We are here 8 months later because the Circuit Court breathed new life into its declaratory judgment. And here's how it did it.
Can I ask a question before you get going on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
When I was a trial court judge, if a case went up on appeal, I always had this notion that there were very limited, very few things that I could do as a judge in that active case. And I certainly didn't think that my authority extended to changing somehow the judgment that was up on appeal. when I take a look at the contempt, it seems to me that in reality what happened in the contempt was that the trial court essentially granted the injunction that the trial court previously denied, thus changing what's up on appeal. So part of what I need to reconcile from both sides, and I won't ask this question twice because time is precious, but what I need to reconcile in my mind is how does a trial court judge think that they have the authority to change that which is currently up on appeal, or is that not what happened?
Well, we argued to the circuit court that it did not have the jurisdiction to entertain either the motion for supplementary injunctive relief back in that was filed by the challengers in April, nor did they have the jurisdiction, nor did the court have the jurisdiction to enter the contempt order. In addition, the circuit court was without competency to issue the contempt order because that contempt motion was brought by parties who were not persons aggrieved under the contempt statute 785.03. You know, I think it's important for the court to recognize the history of this case. When the challengers brought their complaint, they sought declaratory relief. They sought injunctive relief. In their summary judgment motion, they sought declaratory relief. They sought injunctive relief. The circuit court issued declaratory relief but did not issue injunctive relief. And then the challengers in this case, the parties, came back and asked the court for injunctive relief to prevent the commissioners from applying the certification provisions of Act 10 to non-parties. And the circuit court, again, rejected that it would – it rejected that, did not issue that injunctive relief. And then non-party challengers came to court and asked the court to do the exact same thing that the circuit court had rejected from non-challengers. I mean, put another way, the circuit court, when they granted the contempt motion, it issued an order which commanded the commissioners to take certain actions, to undo other actions that they were never under an obligation to refrain from doing in the first place. And I think that gets to the first point, which is that declaratory judgments are never appropriate for contempt. Contempt never lies in a supposed violation of declaratory judgment because a declaratory judgment doesn't command a party to do anything whatsoever. So as the Seventh Circuit articulated in Badger Catholic, a declaratory judgment cannot be enforced by contempt proceedings. In the U.S. Supreme Court, in Steffel versus Thompson, a declaratory judgment is a much milder form of relief than an injunction. Though it may be persuasive, it is ultimately not coercive.
Counsel, I want to shift you back off of looking at the non-party unions that brought this. I want to focus, as I think Justice Ziegler was trying to get you to focus on, whether the order that was issued to non-parties changes the court's decision on an order the court issued requesting essentially the same relief. You want to address that for me, please?
Well, I believe that there is a fair argument that can be made that that's exactly what the circuit court did, that it amended its judgment, which is under appeal. And that is because it imposed what is effectively an injunction on the commissioners that did not exist when the court issued its final order. And to that degree, what is called a contempt might be seen as revising a final order, which would be beyond the circuit court's jurisdiction.
How do you explain 808.07.2a.2?
This is what jurisdiction is retained by the circuit court.
That's right. During the pendency of an appeal, a trial court may suspend, modify, restore, or grant an injunction. And if I understand your argument, you're saying in effect, in October, when this contempt issue came up, that what the trial court was doing was now granting an injunction that it had previously refused to grant. And yet, on the very words of 808.07.2a.2, the legislature gave them that power.
Well, certainly, I believe that the power to issue orders related to injunctions on appeal. They may belong to the appellate court, and in certain limited situations, they can apply and involve the circuit court. Certainly some of those are when there is an injunction that needs to be amended, say, because there's a marriage between two parties and a third child has been born, or a situation like that. But what the circuit court can't do is to take a final judgment, a final order which is under review by this court or the court of appeals, and then change the nature of the final order in its entirety, which is what
it says it can. It can grant an injunction, which it refused to do previously. The other thing that sub 3 says, I don't know that it's sub 3 or subparagraph 3, is a trial court may make any order appropriate to preserve the existing state of affairs or the effectiveness of the judgment subsequently
entered.
It doesn't do that. So they were trying to preserve the existing state of affairs because Judge Cole said you have state officers in the work commissioners. They were there in their official capacity. They govern all of the elections across the state. And they were told this is null and void.
No, well, the status quo.
The plaintiffs may have been local, but your commissioners are statewide, and they were sued in their official capacity.
The state's position is not that a circuit court.
Pardon me?
The state's position is not that a circuit court could not bind the commissioners with respect to third parties. It could do so if it were to have properly issued an injunction in the first instance.
But
that's
can't.
Not what the circuit court did in the declaratory judgment.
That's when right. They did it afterwards, in effect.
Well, actually,
that's
the circuit
position.
Court had the parties had requested supplementary injunctive relief, and the circuit court had denied that.
Well, I think what you were about to say before the most recent colloquy between you and the Chief Justice was that, well, a circuit court may certainly modify its order. It does not have the authority to change the final judgment, which, as someone mentioned earlier, a good case can be made it did by granting the injunction when it refused to do so at the original hearing. Now, besides common sense, what authority do you have for that proposition?
The authority for the proposition that a circuit court may not change its final order while it's on appeal?
Yes.
Well, I do believe that that common sense certainly is one. The nature of this court's jurisdiction is another. But also that when we look at 808, when we look at the appeals in writs of error of 808, I think that we can see the following. 808.075 sub 3 reads that, the circuit court retains the power to act on all issues until the record has been transmitted, and then it only retains the power to act on certain issues. The 80604, I think we should look at that as well, which is the Declaratory Judgment Act, which notes, of course, that a plaintiff can seek declaratory relief, and it can also seek supplemental relief as part of its declaratory judgment action. However, 808.075 sub 1, 808.07 sub 2 and sub 2A2 states the court may suspend, modify, restore, or grant an injunction. But even if the court restored the plaintiff's petition for supplemental relief, the court still should have denied the motion because it sought permanent relief going to the merits of the case. And I think that that's the most important distinction, which is that the permanent relief went to the merits of the underlying case.
Stated another way, the injunction or the lack of, or the circuit court's unwillingness to grant the injunction was the final judgment, where that might not be contemplated in the powers enumerated to a circuit court once a case goes on appeal, because I can't help but wonder why that wouldn't be a complete moving target for the parties, for the lawyers, for the various courts of appeal who have to review the circuit court judge's work. That would beg the question, which decision are we reviewing?
I agree with that analysis entirely. If the court were to adopt a rule that the circuit court can change, fundamentally change its order whenever it wishes, to grant injunctive relief, that would significantly undermine the authority and the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court when they have the case, and it would create uncertainty in every piece of litigation, which would require emergency motion after emergency motion after emergency motion in order to preserve the status quo. And it's important to understand that the status quo in this case was a declaratory judgment order. It was not an injunction. The commissioners have complied with injunctions when they've been issued, like they were in the WEAC case, which was the Western District case that was ultimately reversed by the Seventh Circuit. If there had been a clear command, and this court's precedent requires a clear command, a specific command to a party to do an act or refrain from doing an act. That's what an injunction is, and those are the only kinds of remedies which are enforceable by contempt.
Counsel, my interest in talking about the stay is partially this, but it's more importantly, suppose you got the stay. All right. I want to know what effect the stay would be, because the stay is on 2012 and all subsequent orders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, did work commissioners call off these elections?
Work commissioners are not holding the elections as of this moment.
All right. What did they advise the various school boards and other entities that are affected?
Is that part of the record, counsel?
It's not part of the record. It is my.
Well, we've got an affidavit. I think it's Peter Davis that says commission scored and received 401 separate proposals to prepare. They sent out materials and advised how and what voter eligibility is. And for the elections to take place, the commission must provide the American Arbitration Association with the above-referenced voter list by October 25 or the very latest October 29. You're here. I want to know what's the effect.
Sure. The effect of the stay, first, the request for stay. If a stay were granted, when we had moved, we had requested relief by November 5th.
That's
at the
right.
very latest, because under the regularized processes that the commission had with AAA, the needing to provide notice for elections, needing to have a window for the elections, that was the last date that under those
October
regular...
October 29, and then this affidavit... Mr. Davis is counsel for work, right?
That's correct.
So if elections are not held as scheduled, and if the court doesn't act before November 5, this makes it sound that you can't do it because you need a 20-day calendar day before December 1, and you don't have 20 days before December 1.
The two points that are very important to address: what is the harm if the declaratory judgment remains in place? First, there are municipal elections which occur in May. The
yes.
commission.
Let's talk about this case. I recognize May. I want to know in this case what happens.
Those are the harms if the declaratory judgment remains in place and this court doesn't issue a final decision, it's very likely that the municipal elections in May cannot take
place. I want to know if the court issues a stay before you have requested this, counsel. Are you withdrawing
yes.
your request? If your request is still to have a stay, I want to know what is the effect on the various entities. Now, Madison Teachers did not file in August when it was supposed to if it wanted to be certified. The other union did not file in August because it had a declaration that there was null and void. There were numerous other entities that did not file in August as required by the statute because they had questions, right, about the effect of the
why they chose not to file is not in the record, and it certainly isn't because
well,
they had
Peter
questions.
Davis's,
they had no rights adjudicated.
Peter Davis's affidavit says on December 12, 2012, a year ago, over 30 counties filed a petition for a declaratory ruling with the work concerning the subjects of bargaining between municipal employers and represented employees in light of this 2012 order from the Dane County. Did work, this must be public record, did work issue a declaratory ruling?
I do not believe so.
Pardon me?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. So a year ago, you knew there were issues as to the effect, and you did not go to the circuit court. You did not go elsewhere cleaned up.
I believe at the time that you're referring to, those certification provisions
right.
within Act 10 were enjoined by the district court in the Western District of Wisconsin. The presumption is that the law should be followed, and that
unless somebody declares it null and void.
Your Honor, the commissioners were fully in compliance with Judge Colossus' order. And I think it's important for this court to recognize that Act 10 has been the subject of multiple pieces of litigation. It's been the subject in WEAC, where the Seventh Circuit affirmed it in its entirety. It was the subject in Laborers Local, where the Western District affirmed it in its entirety. It's the subject of the WLEA case, in which the Dane County Circuit Court Branch 1 recently affirmed the constitutional of Act 10 in its entirety. The commissioners at all times have been in compliance with all orders of the court, which is why we're seeking relief from this court now allow for Act 10 to apply.
I want to know if you get the relief you're seeking now. I want to know, does Madison Teachers, Inc., are they recognized as the bargaining unit here? Is Public Employees Local 62 AFL-CIO recognized as the bargaining unit? They did not file and did not comply with the statute.
I can speak to how the commission treated entities when there was an injunction previously in place, and we would certainly see the declaratory judgment as having declared the rights between the parties and the commission. And at that time, they would have recognized them as the agents.
So they're okay. That is, no matter what the stay is.
The plaintiff entities, based on what the commission had done previously, that was their practice when what they had done previously when there was an injunction that had been issued. I'm sure that they would have to meet in a meeting to determine how they would do it again, but that's how they did it last time.
Counselor, what you're saying when there was an injunction, you're talking about the injunction from the Western District of Wisconsin in the federal courts, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So they were in compliance at that particular point in time, and that injunction is not in place anymore.
Correct? That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, a couple of questions. One to follow up on that. Did I understand you to say that you recognize or acknowledge or accept that you are bound by Judge Colas's declaratory judgment decision with regard to the named parties in this action?
That is correct.
Okay. I want to then return to the irreparable harm in the affidavit of Mr. Davis, because you have asked for stays, motion to stay, September 2012, and then also, of course, a motion to stay the contempt.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with the 2012, and I'm looking at Mr. Davis's affidavit that focuses on irreparable harm. In paragraph 12 of his affidavit that was submitted on October 25th, I think it went to the Court of Appeals, and then you brought that up here with your more recent filing in this case. And in paragraph 12, it sets forth the irreparable harm if an immediate stay is not granted. It says, number one, in paragraph 12, if the elections are not held as scheduled, the commission, school districts, and unions will be obligated to compile new voter eligibility lists in each of the 401 elections to reflect changes in the composition of the workforce. So that's the first irreparable harm. My response to that is, I'm glad I don't have to do it. That's lots of work.
but it doesn't rise to irreparable harm, it seems to me.
The irreparable harm is the primary irreparable harm is that any time the state has its law and is enjoined and cannot enforce its law, there is an irreparable harm to the state and to the public interest. And
okay,
that's a statement of law.
I'm going through what is set forth. Yeah, that's your, and you've made that argument as a matter of law. I'm going through what Mr. Davis avers as the, I guess I would say, factual irreparable harm, other than any time legal argument that you make. So the first one doesn't seem to me all that compelling as irreparable harm. Do you want to challenge that, or do you want me to go on to the second one, which is if the elections are not held as scheduled, the commission will be obligated to provide the parties with 401 new notices providing the new election details. Again, I say, I'm glad I don't have to do it, but it's not the kind of stuff that we in the judicial branch normally consider irreparable harm. It's just a hassle and work.
Those are additional harms. The rule of law is that any time the state is prevented from applying its law, there is an irreparable harm to itself and to the public interest. I think that that's a pretty significant irreparable harm.
I am not disagreeing with that. I understand your legal argument with regard to irreparable harm. And let me thank you. Let me give you a moment to find that on if that's what you're looking at right now, on page 4, paragraph 12 of his affidavit. I don't know if that's what you have. If not, I'll just
Your Honor, are you referring to the affidavit that is signed on
October 25th? Yes.
Mm-hmm. We understand your difficulty. We only brought in parts of our files here.
Yeah.
I'm thankful if I can find anything, counsel. You keep looking.
If you can't find it, I'll just speak about it generically. There are three irreparable harms listed and in paragraph 12. In this affidavit, and then there's one other irreparable harm listed in the brief in support of the motion to stay contempt, which I'll get to also. But the three irreparable harms that are listed in the affidavit are, number one, the Elections Commission is obligated to compile new lists. Number two, we got to send out 401 new notices. And number three, the first two to me are not compelling. I'm just telling you. I mean, lots of work, but not irreparable harm. The number three is what I want to focus on then. Commissioners, for the election to take place in accord with the statutory directive is December 1st, right? But not as scheduled, the commissioners must be able to resume administering and enforcing the emergency rules and statutes no later than November 5th. Well, that's come and gone. So tell me what happens. Paragraph 13 says if the elections are not held as scheduled or at least completed during a 20-day calendar period ending December 1, compliance with the statutory mandate is not possible. Tell me about that. I don't know where the 20 days comes from, and I just don't know why it's 10 days rather than 20 days. I don't find 20 in the statute. Maybe I'm not reading the right statute. So I want you to make your best argument on factual irreparable harm.
The 20 days comes from the emergency rules that WERC had promulgated. And in those rules, the WERC decided that the members of the unit shouldn't have to vote all on one day, that they could have the election occur on several days. So that's what the reference to the 20 days is.
That's what I thought, because I couldn't find it, certainly in the statute. December 1st is there. Now, is there anything to preclude you from to having an emergency rule that says 10 days? Or is there anything to preclude you from saying the election will be other than on December 1?
Well, the Court of Appeals certainly suggested in its order that the elections could occur after. And the emergency rules themselves say that an election isn't valid or invalid based on whether it concludes by December 1st. But certainly also direction from this court would be helpful. If the court lifts the stay, I mean, the WRC is going to have to make an assessment based on what this court's order and decision is about whether it would be feasible to have elections for school district bargaining units this December. Certainly beyond that, there are municipal employee elections that are due in May. And rulemaking, even emergency rulemaking, isn't something that can happen overnight consistent with Chapter
227. And that's exactly the last one I was going to get to, the May 4th, I think it is, because that's set forth as a in your Department of Justice brief in support of motion to stay the contempt order, and it says on page 39 of the brief that if the contempt order is not stayed and the appellate courts do not decide the merits of the final order of final order or contempt order well before May 1, I misspoke, I said May 4, it's May 1, 2014, the commissioners will be unable to conduct the annual certification election for the representatives of the general municipal employees. I'll tell you what I get from all of this. I get that the November 1 deadline is passed, the November 5 deadline is passed, the statute says December 1, you have to hold the elections. The statute doesn't say anything about 20 days. You put that in your emergency rule. You also put in your emergency rule almost a no harm, no foul if it isn't by December 1. But you're saying to us, court, you gotta do something by May 1. That's how I interpret all of this with your emergency rules. Am I right or am I wrong? And the statute. Am I right or am I wrong?
We believe that that there's a potential that the municipal employee, that the school district employee elections can be held if the court acts immediately or as soon as possible to grant our stay.
But under your emergency rules, even if it's not by December 1, if there's a no harm, no foul.
Just as plaintiffs are recognized as being bargaining units when there was an injunction in place that didn't allow the law to operate. If I may make an analogy, if there is a statute in place which requires groups of people to submit membership lists to the state, and that law is challenged, or the law says that those lists need to be done by July 1st. They need to be in the state's hand on July 1st. And on June 28th, someone goes and gets a preliminary injunction from a circuit court, and the circuit court grants the injunction, the preliminary injunction, and says this violates the First Amendment because the state can't compel you to give membership lists of your association. And then later, after the appellate process is done, a court of appeals or the Supreme Court reverses that circuit court order and say it's September 1st. That doesn't mean that those who are obligated to provide membership lists don't have to provide membership lists anymore because the date has come and gone. So certainly there is a potential to have annual elections. Now, at some point, it becomes too late or not feasible because we're into next year and we need to have these elections every year.
That's why it seems to me you have reference in your more recent filing of November 7th, on the May 1 deadline that, yes. Hey, you want to tell us that. Let's get things together by then.
Absolutely. It's very important. I mean, we would like them to be able to conduct elections for both. But just if the December 1 elections are not feasible because of the time that this court takes to operate on the motion, we still have those elections, and those are very important. But I'd like to say each election is important because they're about members of a collective bargaining unit and their ability to select representatives of their choice. That's what those elections are about. They're about the right to self-organize.
Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't understand. If we put in a stay on the 2012 and subsequent orders, I don't understand what you'll need. Does everyone get a new, do the people that are to which the statute is applicable, get a new eligibility date, not August 30. Do we have to set a new date for getting the reference voter list to the American Arbitration Association if we want to make it effective now?
If the stay is lifted, we could use the list that were provided to the American Arbitration Association on August 30th. I mean, before the injunction was in place, multiple steps happened that would allow the school district elections to take place. And the commission will have to make a decision based on the court's order as to what to do. But one option is to use what has already been in place before an injunction or a contempt was issued and rely on those. They may decide, if it were consistent with this court's order, to restart that process. That's a decision that they'll have to meet about and make a decision about based on what this court does.
Well, doesn't the court have to say something about all of this, or is this going to be a matters of dispute and fights? There are a number of associations that did not do the appropriate things on August 30 because they thought that the statute was null and void. I mean, that's what the movements in the contempt order said. Are they out of luck? So they're going to be decertified?
The four of the six movements in the contempt order who had had their rights adjudicated in a fully and fairly litigated case, in the WEAC case, claimed that they didn't understand. Now, there were two that said that they didn't understand that that was their obligation. But ignorance of the law is no excuse. Act 10 is on the books, and there was absolutely no injunction in place. And the direction from work that there was a requirement to do it was out there. These are not harms to parties to have the law apply. These are not harms to parties that an injunction that never existed didn't happen. We believe that that the actions of the commission were appropriate. They were consistent with the declaratory judgment order. And to the extent that it would be salvageable, feasible, in fairness in the commission's determination to use what has already been done for these school district elections, if they're able at all to hold the school district elections, then that will be a determination that they will make if there is a stay that is granted. It is, I do agree with Justice Bradley, that the May 1st election is also an extremely important item. The emergency rules will be set to expire. The commission will have to either draft new final rules or new emergency rules. These things take time. And the contempt order right now does not allow the commission to take those steps to draft those rules, to promulgate those rules, to get approval by the governor and the legislature, et cetera.
So I gather you're more concerned about the May deadlines than you are about the deadlines that have already passed.
I mean, that's a little bit like saying, am I concerned about the spring elections or the fall elections? I'm concerned about all elections. All elections are important. With that, I see that my time has been up for a while. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to present the commission's opinions. Are there further questions from the court?
I have a question, if I might, and I'm not trying to prolong things because I know the red light's been on a long time. I just want to be sure I understand correctly. You're asking for a stay of the contempt order. You're asking for a stay generally of what Judge Colas did in September. But the actual contempt appeal is still before the Court of Appeals. Is that correct?
The Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over that appeal. We filed a notice of appeal. However, it comes to this court as an emergency stay pending appeal, and this court can take jurisdiction over that, either appellate jurisdiction or, as the court did in the Guttenschwager case, take original jurisdiction and issue a supervisory writ. It's well within this court's jurisdictional power to stay or set aside that contempt order.
However, we have not, at this point, done anything like that. The stay request is here. The Court of Appeals, as I read what they were telling us, still has the appeal of the finding of contempt.
That's correct, that the underlying appeal is held by the Court of Appeals. But just as with all motions for an emergency stay, pending appeal, the state or the losing party can make a request to this court. The Wisconsin Bankers Association versus Mutual Savings case is on point, using 80807 sub 2 and 80912, because in this case there was no order from the circuit court on a request for a stay. So the court has the opportunity to take jurisdiction. The state certainly interpreted this court's October 29th order, and which was reinforced by this court's November 8th order, as allowing us to present arguments today Whether that was, granting jurisdiction or just indicating to the parties that it was considering granting jurisdiction in its discretion, we've prepared to try to answer your questions as if the court will take jurisdiction.
But the parties who got the stay, who got the contempt order, are not entitled to orally argue today.
This court issued an order on that question on November 8th.
And said no.
That's
right?
Correct.
Is there anyone who's affected by the contempt order that is arguing other than yourself today on that issue?
Well,
that is affected by it. I understand because of your position that work is taking that you are bound by the declaratory judgment issued against the parties in this action. The parties aren't affected by it. They're not affected by it. So is there anyone who's affected by it that's going to be arguing other than you today?
Well, the parties to the case presented argument in circuit court on the contempt order. I mean, the actual parties that are here presented those arguments, and there have been arguments presented to this court. And since you need to have to be in privity with the party to be a person aggrieved, I would assume that the plaintiffs would suggest that they're in privity and can represent their interests.
Yeah, I guess I look at 785.03 perhaps a little differently than you do in terms of the person aggrieved rather than party aggrieved. But they're not aggrieved on contempt because you are agreeing that you are bound by the declaratory judgment as to the parties in this case. Am I correct on that?
Our position is that the declaratory judgment has determined the rights and obligations between the commission and the parties in this case, and that's the matter which is subject to this appeal.
To be clear, counsel, what are the elections that we're talking about?
We're talking about elections to appoint or select a collective bargaining representative over collective bargaining units with respect to school district employees in December, and then in May it would be with respect to other municipal employees who are members of collective bargaining units.
And so approximately how many potential – does the record reveal approximately how many potential voters there are who are eligible to participate in these elections?
I do not believe that the record reveals that, but I think the court can take notice. I believe there's, 431 school districts, and that many of those school districts those school districts all potentially have collective bargaining units, and that within those units they may select or not select a collective bargaining
unit. So it would be every public school employee in all of those districts who would be eligible to vote in this election?
School district employees, that is my understanding, if they are in a collective bargaining unit. So it wouldn't include the superintendent, but it would include everyone else.
All right. And then the May election?
The May election is all municipal employers who are part of collective bargaining units. So those would be city employees, those would be county employees, those would be village employees. It'd also be sewerage district employees. They'd be transit employees. Well, those aren't general employees under the statute.
So every employee, as I hear it, who is employed by a political subdivision of this state or the state itself would be eligible to vote in that election.
That is correct. Between now and May 1st, every single public employee who is employed by a municipal employer as defined by MIRA will have an opportunity or would have an opportunity to vote in a certification election to choose who's going to be
and
their collective bargaining representative.
And so what I hear you arguing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the state is taking the position that if Act 10 is declared, is not found to be unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt, that each and every one of those people who you've enumerated would have the right to vote for their leadership in terms of collective bargaining.
That is correct, through the annual certification elections in MIRA.
And the longer that this court does not act, the longer we are unaware, we are uncertain of what the rights are for all of those employees.
If this court does not act, that's correct. The longer there will be uncertainty, and again, the individual employees will not have the ability through annual elections to certify who their collective bargaining representative is.
So we act by May, we're okay. You're okay.
If
that's not the commission's position, Your Honor.
Okay. What is the commissioner's position?
The commission's position is that that we are seeking a motion for stay. Our position is that this court could act on the papers. It could act immediately, and that the sooner it acts, the more likely it is that we will be able to conduct elections in December. But certainly we need to conduct elections in May as well as December, so that if the court doesn't act, say, by December 31st, and there could be no annual election this year, we still have another election that's right around the corner.
To be clear,
we have to back up because we have to pass emergency.
I thought you were finished.
Yes, Your Honor.
To be clear, the September election, you're not giving up. The state is not conceding. The state is not conceding that the December elections simply cannot take place.
The state does not concede that the December elections cannot take place. It will have to be a decision made by work or by the commissioners after receiving this court's order, and it may depend on what the court's order says.
And as I understand it, there is a statutory deadline of December 21. I believe that's the date.
December 1st is the statutory deadline. Under the emergency rules, the election won't be valid or invalid if they are not concluded by December 1. But certainly those rules, they envision a 20-day election period, and there still needs to be notice to parties.
So what relief are you seeking in regard – what relief is the state seeking in regard to the December elections? Because it needs a certain amount of time, which I have not heard. I have certainly read the briefs where we read originally November 5, I think, then November 7, but definitely by a date certain. Is it in the record how much time the state needs to conduct the December election?
It is not in the record to determine – it is not in the record how much time it would need to conduct that election under a different set of circumstances than the one that we moved for. When we originally moved – backing up from December 1st, applying the emergency rule and all the normal processes that were in place, we needed by November 5th. But the commission does need to meet after an order in order to set election dates, et cetera, and that has not occurred yet.
And
it can't occur while they're under contempt order.
What does that mean? What's the answer to my question? Is it in the record how much time the state needs?
It is not in the record how much time the state needs. Well, there is one part in the record, which is that if the court had issued its relief by the 5th, then the elections could have occurred by the 1st.
So, with that information to go on, what, what, if anything, are you asking us to do about it?
We're asking the court to stay or set aside the contempt order and the declaratory judgment pending the outcomes of the appeals. Or you could exercise supervisory writ and just set aside the contempt order altogether, which was issued without basis in law. Having said that, what we are asking the court to do is when the stay is issued, if the stay were to be granted by this court, that the stay would relieve the commissioners of their obligations under the contempt order, which say that they can't hold the elections, that the commissioners would then meet to determine whether or not it was feasible to conduct an annual election within this year. And again, that meeting hasn't occurred. We could tell you with certainty when we moved that if we got the order by November 5th that we'd be able to conduct elections by the 1st, but I'm afraid I cannot say with certainty what the commission's decision will be if, say, the order comes out on the 15th. But if you back up dates, an election could certainly commence by December 1st if an order were issued, doing some math, by the 20th to the 21st. But again, the commission has to meet and make those determinations about how to conduct the election.
All right.
Does the election have to end by December 1, or can the election occur after December 1?
I think there are three answers to this. First, the emergency rule says that the election wouldn't be valid or invalid if it does not conclude by December 1. Second, the Court of Appeals almost invited that this election could occur at another time since there's been an order which has prevented its occurrence now. And I guess third would just be the analogy to the law that would require membership lists to be distributed that I made. Certainly this court's decision of order can...
What does the statute say?
The statute says December 1st.
The statute says December 1, and you're asking this court to modify the statute.
No, Your Honor. What I'm requesting that this court do is, what would occur in a world in which a law had another effective date and the state was enjoined from applying the law? The law doesn't disappear because it could not accomplish its statutory responsibilities by a certain day. If the court issues a stay, and allows those elections to occur, again, work is going to have to determine what is feasible and achievable within this year. But we don't believe that the statute in itself would prevent the election from being valid, again, given the circumstances of the stay. I'm sorry, given the circumstances of the injunction.
That makes some sense to me, but do you have any legal authority that would allow this court to change the December 1st deadline? Essentially, I hear you arguing that the court could change the December 1st deadline under the circumstances as presented here. You've got an injunction, you know, it may be under the injunction, it's possible, impossible to meet the deadline, and then the court could change the statutory deadline, or work could change the statutory deadline. Do you have any legal authority for either of those?
Well, I would say that the court's authority, when the court issues a stay, the court is providing a party is providing the party injunctive relief. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of what a stay is, and that in that injunctive release, it could specify what parties can and cannot do.
Well, my question really comes from a perspective of, oh my goodness, can this court write legislation? No. Legislation said December 1st. Sounds like December 1st, unless some people think it's unclear. But if it's clear, then it's December 1st. But you're arguing it doesn't have to be December 1st, it seems to me, that the work can change the legislative date, or and maybe, are you arguing that we can change the legislative date, or aren't you arguing
that? I'm not arguing that the court can change or rewrite the statute. What I'm arguing is that the court can grant relief when it issues an injunction and consider the equities at stake.
Yeah, I know. And I understand the equities. The equities, in part, would include, look, we weren't able to hold it on December 1st. It was an impossibility. I'm saying this a bit theoretically, hypothetically. So, give us a little room here. And that makes sense to me. I'm just asking for if you have any legal authority for that.
It has to do with the nature of the court's it has to do with the nature of a court's equitable judicial authority to issue equitable relief. And the motion for stay is, again, a request for equitable relief.
But the issue is we can grant a stay. The issue is what's the effect of that stay. So we agreed, I thought, that as to the parties, the MTI and the employers local, they are okay. They don't have to be certified because they followed the rule, right?
I informed the court what the WERC did with respect to parties that could not
comply. Okay, so they're not governed by this. They're okay. As to everyone else, your position is they are not governed by the declaration of invalidity. Therefore, they can have an election. Seems to me they have to go back to what they had to do on August 29th or 30th. Because some of them thought that they were or weren't covered or were protected by COAS, and you were so advised, according to Davis. So it seems to me that the issue is not granting a stay, but what is the effect of that stay on all of the parties, including the ones who got the contempt order. So that's where...
And I'm pleased that the court is entertaining the idea of granting the stay. But I believe I'm not sure that I have anything to add from what I've stated previously on the same questions.
Tough issue.
And I've tried my best to answer them for the court.
But I think,
and done well.
I think the answer, you got to it, you sort of addressed it at the last part of your colloquy with Justice Bradley, when you talked about how the court may consider the equities. However, is it not true that a petition for injunctive relief, such as that granted by Judge Kolas, and also the petition for the stay, which is another form of injunctive relief, which the state now seeks from this court, are rooted in the equitable powers of each respective court?
Yes, Your Honor.
And as part of the equitable powers of the court must consider the fairness, because that is the other word for equitable powers.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
And can change a statute. And can change a statute.
The court does not change statutes. The court grants relief to parties.
I see.
Court doesn't void statute, or the court doesn't veto statutes. The court commands parties to do or refrain from doing certain items. If there are no
Justice Prosser.
How does all this affect state employees?
This case has no effect on state employees. The CELRA was not challenged in this litigation. CELRA has been upheld by the Dane County Circuit Court Branch 1. CELRA has been upheld by the WEAC case. So at this point, state employee elections as they relate to selecting collective bargaining representatives are moving forward.
Okay. Does the contempt injunction have any effect on state employees?
No, Your Honor, it does not. It does not. It only restrains actions by the commission as they relate to municipal employees.
That was the sole purpose of the trial court.
I think, though, that there's a related statute provision that's not an issue, you would argue, in this case, that's verbatim. The municipal provisions at issue have verbatim related state provisions.
That's absolutely correct. And actually, that's one of the points which I think is very important for the court to consider as it considers this the scope of the declaratory judgment at all, which is that circuit courts can disagree as to how they find the constitutionality of a statute. And the exact same theories, the precise same theories that were offered in this case, the MTI litigation, were offered in the WLEA case, and additional theories in the WLEA case as well, and a different circuit court upheld the law in its entirety. Thank you.
Mr. St. John, I'm sorry, but I forgot to ask a question to Mr. Van Hollen, and that is, do municipal employers deduct contributions to other entities than unions?
I believe that there's an opportunity for Mr. Van Hollen on rebuttal.
Okay. That's good. You're right. He can answer it then.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. St. John. The court's going to take a few minutes in recess, and the subject of discussion will be whether we take lunch now or proceed for another 50 minutes if we, which is 45 minutes plus 5, which may be a longer period than that. We are in recess for about 5 minutes. Thank you.
now, so we'll be back at about 1:05, and we will then proceed and complete the argument unless there's an objection by counsel. 1:05. What time is it now? We have 1:15. Okay. 1:05. All right.